feathered friend. To the best of my knowledge, there's never been a regulation that forbids one to keep pets in a space station. No one ever thought it was necessary, and even had such a rule existed, I am quite certain that Sven Olsen would have ignored it. With a name like that, you will picture Sven at once as a 6'6" Nordic giant built like a bull with a voice to match. Had this been so, his chances of getting a job in space would have been very slim. Actually, he was a wiry little fellow, like most of the early spacers, and managed to qualify easily for the 150-pound bonus that kept so many of us on a reducing diet. Sven was one of our best construction men, and excelled at the tricky and specialized work of collecting assorted girders as they floated around in freefall, making them do the slow-motion, three-dimensional ballet that would get them into their right positions, and fusing the pieces together when they were precisely dovetailed into the intended pattern. I never tired of watching him and his gang as the station grew under their hands like a giant jigsaw puzzle. It was a skilled and difficult job, for a spacesuit is not the most convenient of garbs in which to work. However, Sven's team had one great advantage over the construction gangs you see putting up skyscrapers down on Earth. They could step back and admire their handiwork without being abruptly parted from it by gravity. Don't ask me why Sven wanted a pet, or why he chose the one he did. I'm not a psychologist. But I must admit that his selection was very sensible. Claribel weighed practically nothing. Her food requirements were infinitesimal, and she was not worried, as most animals would have been, by the absence of gravity. I first became aware that Claribel was aboard when I was sitting in the little cubbyhole laughingly called my office, checking through my list of technical stores to decide what items we'd be running out of next. When I heard the musical whistle beside my ear, I assumed that it had come over the station intercom and waited for an announcement to follow. It didn't. Instead, there was a long and involved pattern of melody that made me look up with such a start that I forgot all about the angle beam just behind my head. When the stars had ceased to explode before my eyes, I had my first view of Claribel. She was a small yellow canary, hanging in the air as motionless as a hummingbird, and with much less effort, for her wings were quietly folded along her sides. We stared at each other for a minute. Then, before I had quite recovered my wits, she did a curious kind of backward loop I'm sure no earthbound canary had ever managed, and departed with a few leisurely flicks. It was quite obvious that she'd already learned how to operate in the absence of gravity and did not believe in doing unnecessary work. Sven didn't confess to her ownership for several days, and by that time it no longer mattered, because Claribel was a general pet. He had smuggled her up on the last ferry from Earth when he came back from leave. Partly, he claimed, out of sheer scientific curiosity. He wanted to see just how a bird would operate when it had no weight, but could still use its wings. Claribel thrived and grew fat. On the whole, we had little trouble concealing our unauthorized guest when VIPs from Earth came visiting. The space station has more hiding places than you can count. The only problem was that Claribel got rather noisy when she was upset, and we sometimes had to think fast to explain the curious peeps and whistles that came from ventilating shafts and storage bulkheads. There were a couple of narrow escapes, but then who would dream of looking for a canary in a space station? We were now on 12-hour watches, which was not as bad as it sounds, since you need little sleep in space. Though, of course, there is no day and night when you are floating in permanent sunlight, it was still convenient to stick to the terms. Certainly, when I woke up that morning, it felt like 6 a.m. on Earth. I had a nagging headache and vague memories of fitful, disturbed dreams. It took me ages to undo my bunk straps, and I was still only half awake when I joined the remainder of the duty crew in the mess. Breakfast was unusually quiet, and there was one seat vacant. "Where's Sven?" I asked, not very much caring. "He's looking for Claribel," someone answered. "Says he can't find her anywhere. She usually wakes him up." Before I could retort that she usually woke me up too, Sven came in through the doorway, and we could see at once that something was wrong. He slowly opened his hand, and there lay a tiny bundle of yellow feathers with two clenched claws sticking pathetically up into the air. "What happened?" we asked, all equally distressed. "I don't know," said Sven mournfully. "I just found her like this." "Well, let's have a look at her," said Jock Duncan, our cook-doctor-dietitian. We all waited in hushed silence while he held Claribel against his ear in an attempt to detect any heartbeat. Presently he shook his head. "Can't hear anything. but that doesn't prove she's dead. I've never listened to a canary's heart," he added rather apologetically. "Give her a shot of oxygen," suggested somebody, pointing to the green-branded emergency cylinder in its recess beside the door. Everyone agreed that this was an excellent idea, and Clarabelle was tucked snugly into a face mask that was large enough to serve as a complete oxygen tent for her. To our delighted surprise, she revived at once. Beaming broadly, Sven removed the mask, and she hopped onto his finger. She gave her series of come-to-the-cookhouse boys trills, then promptly keeled over again. "I don't get it," lamented Sven. "What's wrong with her? She's never done this before." For the last few minutes, something had been tugging at my memory. My mind seemed to be very sluggish that morning, as if it was still unable to cast off the burden of sleep. I felt that I could do with some of that oxygen. But before I could reach the mask, understanding exploded in my brain. I whirled on the duty engineer and said urgently, "Jim, there's something wrong with the air. That's why Clarabelle's passed out. I've just remembered that miners used to carry canaries down to warn them of gas." "Nonsense," said Jim. "The alarms would have gone off. We've got duplicate circuits operating independently." "The second alarm circuit isn't connected up yet," his assistant reminded him. That shook Jim. He left without a word, while we stood arguing and passing the oxygen bottle around like a pipe of peace. He came back 10 minutes later with a sheepish expression. It was one of those accidents that couldn't possibly happen. We'd had one of our rare eclipses by Earth's shadow that night. Part of the air purifier had frozen up, and the single alarm in the circuit had failed to go off. $500,000 worth of chemical and electronic engineering had let us down completely. Without Clarabelle, we should soon have been slightly dead. So now, if you visit any space station, don't be surprised if you hear an inexplicable snatch of bird song. There's no need to be alarmed. On the contrary, in fact, it will mean that you're being doubly safeguarded at practically no extra expense. Take a deep breath. A long time ago, I discovered that people who've never left Earth have certain fixed ideas about conditions in space. Everyone knows, for example, that a man dies instantly and horribly when exposed to the vacuum that exists beyond the atmosphere. You'll find numerous gory descriptions of exploded space travelers in the popular literature, and I won't spoil your appetite by repeating them here. Many of those tales, indeed, are basically true. I've pulled men back through the airlock who were very poor advertisements for spaceflight. Yet, at the same time, there are exceptions to every rule, even this one. I should know, for I learned the hard way.